Thanks for having me here at Perimeter. I want to tell you about work I've been doing with Frank Pullman, who's at the Max Planck in Dresden, and Roger, who is a grad student with me at Berkeley and now at Caltech. And the problem is, first, how can we use the infinite density matrix normalization group to find the ground states of the quantum Hall problem on an infinite cylinder? And then once we have them, what measurements could you do on them to figure out what the nature of the order is? Okay, so first, a very rough overview of why there's a problem here. So traditionally, if we're trying to describe what the order of the state is, we do so through the paradigm of symmetry breaking. So if you have something like an icing model, when it's hot, it's disordered, and when it's cold, it orders. And to figure out what the order is, it's sufficient to do some local measurement, just of the magnetization. So another way of phrasing this is, if you pick some region, which is the size of a correlation length, and form the reduced density matrix for it, that reduced density matrix knows everything there is to know about the ground state. There's no other information. So if you have topological order, however, such as the quantum Hall effect, which we have this classic picture here of the Hall resistance, right? In this case, it's actually the conductivity as a function of the filling fraction, something entirely different happens. And we find that here the order can't be characterized by any local density operator. So the question is, what are the non-local measurements, in our case in numerics, that we could do in order to figure out what the nature of the topological order is? Okay, so as a schematic of this, the goal would be somehow you could start with a microscopic Hamiltonian, so not a model one, but just try and approximate what the actual physics is. And then we're going to have some machine. This isn't actually a sausage maker, it's a hand-ground coffee grinder. Which we could put this Hamiltonian into, and then we'd be able to read off what describes the topological order, which is this various data of a topological quantum field theory. So these are things like the statistics that particles have when they braid, the quantum dimensions, how particles fuse together when you bring them near each other. And so this is formalized in these data such as the S and T and R matrices. So the picture is we'd be able to start in the UV with some microscopic Hamiltonian, and then use DMRG, in our case, to study two different length scales. So in the end, we kind of want to study that at the longest length scales and the lowest energies in infrared, all that's left is braiding and statistics. And so this is the information of the topological quantum field theory. But in between, there's also lots of other interesting physics, which actually have to do with energetics and dynamics. And so, I mean, part of the benefit of being able to work with a microscopic Hamiltonian is that there's actually interesting physics in between. And whether or not you're going to see these IR characteristics depends on what the physics is in this intermediate region as well. So we'd like to have a method where we can study both. Okay, so the outline of the talk is, first I'll review why we might want to use DMRG in this context and some basic concepts of topological order. Then I'll review what the quantum Hall problem is on an infinite cylinder. And then I'll briefly describe what the DMRG algorithm is. And then we'll go to two applications. So the first is we'll propose one measurement, which is that of something called the modular T matrix. And so that's going to teach us three things about the state. And all of them are universal. So one's the Hall viscosity. The other is the chiral central charge. And the third is the topological spins of the quasi-particles. So I'll explain why that's the case. And then the third application is more in this intermediate region where we'll be able to generate anions, pin them, and then move them around and measure properties of them. Okay, so first three reasons why we might use IDMRG in two dimensions. So the first one's somewhat boring, but it's important, which is just what the computational complexity is. So the benchmark in quantum Hall for a long time has been exact diagonalization. So we have some finite region, either a sphere or cylinder or a torus. And the complexity of computing the ground state just goes exponentially in the area. So traditionally, if you want to say how hard your numerics were, the only relevant number basically is the number of electrons. That's the area of the system. So one improvement you could make, and in the context of quantum Hall, this is done over the last 10 years or so, is to use finite DMRG. So we take our region, and somehow it doesn't really matter what the details are, we partition it into a bunch of sites which make it look like a one-dimensional problem. Okay, and the benefit of DMRG comes from the factor in this exponential here. So since my if I cut the, let's say, a cylinder in half, I'm going to have some transverse cross section, which is Lx. So the entanglement between the two halves of the system goes like Lx because of the area law. And it's that entanglement which sets the difficulty of DMRG. So if you use DMRG, your exponential goes from being in the area of the system to just some transverse cross section. And that could be a huge reduction. Okay, there's also a prefactor here, which is Lx, Ly, or again, the area. And that's because when you're doing the DMRG, you need to optimize some number of sites, which is just extensive in the area. Okay, so the other improvement we could make is if we assume there's translational invariance along our geometry, we can get rid of this prefactor because now we only need to basically store data from one site. And so this is the infinite DMRG algorithm, which we're going to apply here to the cylinder. So once you've phrased it in this way, the number of electrons is irrelevant. It's infinity. So the difficulty is entirely just in what the circumference of your cylinder is, which we'll say is Lx here. Okay, and I should say as an aside, we might ask, well, why not use PEPs, which is really a tensor network approach suited to two dimensions. And I don't want to make too strong a statement here, but there's a good chance that if your state has chiral topological order, so on the edge, it would have chiral edge modes, that PEPs might not be an efficient way to proceed. Okay, but we do know that for quantum Hall, Roger and I actually showed earlier that the model wave functions, which you can think of as kind of like being the AKLT state for the quantum Hall problem, actually does have an expression as a matrix product state, which is the space in which DMRG works. And you can actually work out an analytic expression for the matrix product state using some tricks from CFT. So there's a good chance that matrix product states are a pretty efficient way to work for these quantum Hall states. Okay, another example I'll just say quickly, another advantage is if you're using some matrix product state algorithms, there's a lot of different geometries you can work on. So there's the infinite cylinder, which I'll mainly discuss. If you want, you could also work on a problem with an infinitely long edge. So then you could study the critical behavior on the edge of these. And so here, for instance, I'm plotting the real space correlation functions on the edge, which become power laws. You can play these tricks to have an infinite cylinder but with some defects in some interior region and then introduce quasi-particles. Or if you wanted, you could use a half-infinite cylinder, and then you'd have an edge which would be just a right mover on the circular end of it. Okay, but the reason we're really going to focus on is the topological aspect of the problem. Okay, so as Lukasz already told you, if you do IDMRG, you can use this geometry of an infinite cylinder. And they worked out a lot of this story in the case of a lattice. So conceptually, it's pretty similar to what we're doing. And the interesting thing about an infinite cylinder is that when you have topological order, you get this topologically protected ground state degeneracy. So there's going to be M degenerate ground states on the problem when we put it on an infinite cylinder. So the interesting thing about topological order is there's indications which have been worked out over the last decade or so that even if we just had the ground states, so no excited states above it, those ground states already hold a lot of the information about the excitations above the ground state, which are the quasi-particles and their braiding. So the program here is by just numerically getting the ground states, how do we extract the information about the quasi-particles themselves, which is what characterizes the topological order. Okay, so first a kind of rough sketch of why the ground states alone might be enough to tell you about the excitations. So imagine I start with one ground state, which I'll say why we call it this later, but let's just call it the one ground state. Okay, so in our theory, because it has topological order, we have some set of anions, which I'll use some Latin letter to designate. So we have some finite set of them. So for the quantum Hall, it would be the one anion, which is just there's nothing there, and then the quasi-electron and the quasi-hole. So I'd have three of these. Okay, so what we can do is we can take a pair of anions, an anion and its antiparticle, and we can imagine adiabatically forming it out of the vacuum. Now, if we pull one to left infinity and one to right infinity, it's as if we've put this trajectory of a quasi-particle along the whole cylinder. So the way to think of this is, let's just pretend it's electromagnetism. It's sort of like I have a charge at right infinity and a negative charge at left infinity. So what you would have threading between them is some flux, a E-flux. And that flux here we just call a topological flux. So the special thing about this state one is that we're guaranteed when we do this, the resulting state, which we'll call A, is orthogonal to one we started with. And we can do this for every quasi-particle in the theory. So this is going to give us, by definition, m different states, which are the m degenerate ground states we have on an infinite cylinder. So this is a special basis of the degenerate ground states, right? Because any superposition of them is, again, a degenerate ground state. And this special basis has been called the minimal entanglement basis, or the minimal entanglement states. And that's because if we cut them in half, they have less entanglement than a general superposition of them. Okay, so the thing is, how would I would tell I'm in the one state versus the A state? So as I said, there's no local measurement. If you form some local reduced density matrix in a contractible region, like just some little patch, they'd be identical between these two states. All the measurements are the same. So we can again refer to E and M. How would I figure out that this charge is here? Well, what I would do is I would form some Gaussian surface and measure the flux through it. And that would tell me that there's a charge inside the surface. So the surface we're going to use here can be an entanglement cut. So if we cut the system in half to find some bipartition, I can look at the entanglement between the left part of the cylinder and the right part of the cylinder. So the way these are usually plotted here in two dimensions are as these so-called entanglement spectra. So I have entanglement between the left and right. And because the momentum around the cylinder is a good quantum number, all the entanglement eigenvalues, or the Schmidt coefficients in this entanglement decomposition, have an associated momentum with them, which is the momentum that the Schmidt state has in the left, say in region A. So when we plot all these eigenvalues, we can filter them by the momentum they have, k. So when this was first done by Haldane and Lee, they found that if you look at the spectrum here, it actually looks a lot like the CFT you would have on the edge. And the important thing is, if you compare the two states and you look at the counting of it at low energies, they actually differ. One goes 1, 1, 3, and one goes 1, 2, 4. So this, I took data from the Moore Reed state. So this is, the bottom one is the entanglement spectrum if you let this quasi-particle here be the one of the non-abelian anions in the state. So the goal somehow is going to be, well, if these entanglement spectra are able to tell that there's a particle here, what are the measurements I can make on the entanglement spectrum which would then tell me about the quasi-particle? Okay, so just to review the first example of this, if I look at what these entanglement spectra look like for some realistic state, I have one here is for the two-fifth state. They're actually very, very messy. They're not as clean in the last two I saw. So you're not going to be able to look at it and obviously say, oh, this is the CFT. I know everything now. You want some kind of thermodynamic measurement you can make, which will automatically give you quantities you want to know about. So the first example of this was found in 2006, both by Kataev and Preskill and Levin and Wen, and it's the topological entanglement entropy. So the idea is you take all your entanglement eigenvalues, which are here pi, and you calculate the von Neumann entropy of them. And then if you look at how that von Neumann entropy scales with the circumference of the cylinder, you find that there's this area law part, which is AL, but then there's this constant part, which is called the topological entanglement entropy. And the result actually depends on which of these ground states you measure. So that's this subscript here, gamma A, or the A. So it depends, A would label the various ground states. So there's basically two things you learn. One is that if gamma A is greater than zero, then that's certainly a necessary condition for there to be topological order. But also, if you measure all of them, you can get these DAs individually, and these are called the quantum dimensions. And if you measure one of them to be larger than one, then you know that that quasi-particle actually has non-abelian statistics. So just as a quick example of how this actually works, The first state I'll look at is a quantum Hall state at two-fifths filling, which is abelian. So in this case, since it's abelian, all the dA are one, and it doesn't matter which ground state you make the cut on. So all you need to do is we take our infinite cylinder at a bunch of different circumferences. So that's the x-axis here, L. And then at each circumference, I measure the entanglement entropy between two halves of the cylinder and try and get the cylinder to be very large. So we can see, in fact, that eventually it becomes linear, but the intercept here is negative, and that's the topological entanglement entropy. So then in the second panel to the right, I've done fits to it to extract out this constant part, and we see it starts out by oscillating. You wouldn't be able to measure anything, but if you can get the circumference large enough, eventually it converges to some number here, which is within about a percent or so of 1/2 log 5, which tells us about the quantum dimensions of the state. So this was attempted earlier using ED, and they are very successful for the 1/3 state, but it's just a matter of how large they could get there, and they couldn't quite get to a large enough circumference to be able to really accurately do.
So are these already results from your work?
Yeah, this was from the last work.
So these are entropies. You take the cylinder, you make a cut.
Yep.
And is this related to real space? Is that a real space entropy?
Right, so that's a good question. So I'll explain a little bit this distinction. There's a distinction in quantum Hall between whenever we do an entanglement cut, you have to specify what two Hilbert spaces you're cutting between. So in quantum Hall, you can imagine doing it in real space, but also, as we'll show, there's these Landau levels. So there's another cut called the orbital cut. And in principle, you could get different results depending on which way you cut it. So this is actually for the orbital cut. But so for the topological entanglement entropy, at least in all the cases I've known, people have never found a discrepancy between what you get in real space
So you get
and,
the right result.
yeah.
So now it's a matter of understanding why.
Yeah.
Or is it clear that it should be?
So for some of the measurements I'll show you, it's clear. I don't know that anyone has a proof for the topological entanglement entropy. So you could say, in some ways, doing a cut in real space versus in orbital space differ by the application of some operators which act around like a ring of the cylinder.
So it's a localized value.
So, well, it's localized in one direction, but not the other. So that's a good question. I don't have a definite like proof at this point for why the orbital and real space give the same result. Okay, so just one more quick example would be a more interesting case is if we have a state where we think there's non-abelian anions. So in this case, the topological entanglement entropy depends on which ground state you make a measurement in. So what I've so our the state here we're looking at is the famous Moore-Reed state. So in this case, what I've plotted here is the difference in the entanglement entropy between two different ground states. So one ground state I've called sigma because it's associated with the sigma quasiparticle, and the other one is one because there's no quasi, well, it doesn't correspond to a quasiparticle. So when I plot the difference between these two and take the circumference to be large, again, it oscillates, but it starts converging to the log of square root 2, which is a good indication. I mean, this was certainly known for the model wave function of this state, that there's an associated non-abelian quasiparticle sigma with non-trivial quantum dimensions. Okay, so now I'll actually get into detail about what the problem looks like for quantum Hall, and how we get the ground states. So first, a brief introduction to what the one-body physics of quantum Hall is on a cylinder. So I have a cylinder, and I have a very strong magnetic field. And in this case, I'll use what's called the Landau gauge. So you can see in this Landau gauge, there's no dependence on x. So that means that the momentum in the x direction is going to be a good quantum number for this problem. So if you just solve a free electron in a strong magnetic field in this gauge, we find that the states are these orbitals I've written the form up in the far right. So there's two things to note. One, around the cylinder, it's a plane wave with momentum kn. And the interesting thing is that in the y direction, which is along the cylinder, it's a localized Gaussian. But the center of this Gaussian depends on the momentum kn. So if you have larger momentum when kn is right, then it's a Gaussian farther to the right, and vice versa. So schematically, we can represent all the states here as these Gaussians, which are lined up in order. So this will be for n equals 0, 1, 2, 3, et cetera. OK, so since they're localized in the y direction, it's pretty obvious how to represent it as a spin chain. I just, for each of these Gaussians, I consider there to be a site there. And since we're working with fermions, all I need to do is specify whether the site is emptied or filled. So my Hilbert space is just a string of bits. Yeah.
Can you relate this picture to the one where we started working on the plane?
Yeah, so one way to think about it, so if I was in the plane, again, on the plane, it actually, it depends on the gauge you use. If you use this gauge on the plane, then you get the same states. They're just localized like this, and they're plane waves like this. And the only difference is that n isn't quantized now, because the reason n's quantized is because I need it to be periodic in the x direction. So that's one gauge. So the gauge you might be more familiar with is I instead use 1/2 negative y, comma x. And this is called the circular gauge. And in that case, they're localized in circular rings like this. It depends on the gauge which you're going to use. Here, you definitely want to use, on the cylinder, you want to use this negative y zero gauge because you can't write down the symmetric one.
But is it correct to think about the cylinder as what happens when you take the plane, and now you take the origin of the plane into minus infinity?
Yeah, so you can imagine, like you're saying, kind of putting a puncture here,
and
then doing a conformal transformation, and then it looks like the cylinder.
Is that correct?
So
as you move in the y direction, it would be the first one to expand in the cylinder.
Yeah, it's almost exactly true that, for instance, if you take the Laughlin state, which on a cylinder is zi minus zj, cubed, and then a factor I'm going to ignore. So the Laughlin state on a plane in this gauge is for each particle I put it in some cubic form here. If you actually do the conformal transformation that you're describing to take a plane to a cylinder, you get the Laughlin state on a cylinder. The only thing is actually this stuff part knows about the magnetic length and doesn't transform it simply. So this idea of thinking of it as a conformal transformation is correct for part of it, but not quite for this part. Okay, so it's important here, though, even though we've made it look like a 1D spin chain, to understand what locality is. So these Gaussians here, by the way, I've chosen units in which the magnetic length is set to 1. These Gaussians always have a width of 1. But the distance between them is going like 2 pi over L. So that means at circumference L, each orbital overlaps with on the order of L other orbitals. So that means if I write down a interaction which is local in real space, in this orbital space, it's going to have interactions on the order of L orbitals. So by the time you get to, say, a circumference of 20, there's going to be interactions between sites which are 10, 20, 30 apart. So this spin chain, if you want to think of it as a spin chain, is it's fairly non-local. But I will say that because these are exponentially localized, once they're far enough apart, then in the spin language, all these interactions decay as Gaussians. So we're always going to consider, since we're working just in the lowest Landau level, so in principle, for every Landau level, there's an equivalent set of orbitals. The filling fraction of the problem is just the number of electrons I have per orbital in my chain. So that's new. Okay, so the symmetries of the problem, there's two. One, there's the conserved electron number, which is charge. And second, which I'll call K, is the fact that the momentum around the cylinder is conserved. Now, once I map it to a plane, as I said, the momentum is tied to its location. So the X momentum of this, or the X momentum takes this kind of funny form where it's basically the position of the site is the momentum. So some people call the momentum the center of mass. So one of the tricky things when you're doing numerics is you have this conserved quantity which depends on the site. So these are our two quantum numbers. Okay, so the Landau level is infinitely degenerate, so there's no one body physics anymore. So all the physics, the Hamiltonian, just comes from the interactions. Okay, so as I said, if I think of this as this quantum number as the center of mass of the particles, the most general thing you could do to conserve center of mass is to take two electrons and either squeeze them in a symmetric fashion or squeeze them out. So those are called the squeezing and unsqueezing relations. So the form that the interaction is going to take is a sum of squeezing and unsqueezing. So if I want to write that out, the form doesn't matter that much. I have two parameters, A and B, which is how far in you squeezed, and once you've squeezed, how far apart the electrons still are.
I'm sorry, yep. Do you have to think that the origin is in the middle there, or?
No.
It's... So N is labeling these orbitals?
Yeah, N is labeling these orbitals.
And do we have zero somewhere and negative N, or?
Yeah, so, okay, so if I was ignoring, so ignore the form of K, which seems to refer to N explicitly. If I ignore that, the form of the Hamiltonian is completely translation invariant along the chain. So there's no need to really think of there as being an origin. N takes this weird form where, so the weird thing about K is when I write it this way, it doesn't commute with translation. But the Hamiltonian just, you can see from the form here that it's translation invariant. So if you have periodic boundary conditions, then N is all integers. And if you have anti-periodic boundary conditions, it's all half integers. Does that answer the...
The boundary conditions, meaning
so,
on the horizontal direction?
Oops. So the reason here that I have, so remember it's a plane wave X around the cylinder.
Right.
So the reason N is quantized is to make it either periodic around the cylinder or anti-periodic. So, yes, that determines whether N is integer or half integer.
On your X direction.
Right. Right, so because in the Y direction, I'm not considering at this point that there's no periodicity, it's just infinite.
So when you were saying foundation invariant of the Hamiltonian, that is in the Y direction?
Right, so it's both. So K is conserved because I have translation variance continuously in X. But then I also have a discrete translation invariance in Y, which is just to move along the sites. So as a spin chain, it looks like a translation invariant spin chain, but with a weird conservation law. Okay, so A, so basically the most general Hamiltonian I can write down, knowing that there's this discrete translation invariance and this conservation of K, is going to have two parameters left, so VAV. And so we should ask, well, how many terms are in this? Well, we said A and B are both on the order of L, where L is the circumference because of the way these Gaussians overlap. So since A and B I can think of as both ranging over on the order of L terms, the number of non-zero VAB you have is on the order of L squared. So another way to put this is, suppose, so I have these four particles in a line here. If I fix one, so fixing the first term I, and then I look at all hoppings involving that one site, there's going to be on the order of L squared of them. So in our case, that might be 1 to 2 to 300 terms. So there's a huge amount of terms in the Hamiltonian. So just to make a connection to how people usually talk about this, you can specify the interaction between any two particles in real space is just some potential V, depending on the distance. So traditionally, People have parameterized, so you might want V to be 1 over R, which would be the Coulomb interaction, or 1 over R cubed, which people call the dipole interaction. So Haldane showed that rather than thinking about it in terms of V of R, people usually decompose it into a string of numbers called the Haldane pseudopotentials. So if you specify the strength of all the Vm they're called, then you could work back from that and get the what the potential is in real space and vice versa. And the only thing you really need to know about them is that when M is low, like V0 and V1, those are the very, very short range. So that'd be like just a delta interaction. And the higher Vm are slightly longer range components of the interaction. And then there's some formula you can put Vm through in order to determine the VAB. So, but occasionally on the slides, I'll specify what Vm we're using here. So any questions about? Yeah.
So is it correct that VAB decreases exponentially in A? Right?
Precisely. So it.
But not in B.
So if it's a little bit different if this is 1 over R, but let's say you add in real space a delta function. Yeah, good. So let's say in real space it's a delta function. You'll find that VAB will decrease as a Gaussian both in A and in B. Right. So for Coulomb, it's definitely going to be localized as a Gaussian in A, but in B, it could be more like 1 over R. Right. So in the simulations we'll do here, we'll always truncate to, let's say, the first 13 pseudopotentials. So eventually, it always decays as a Gaussian both in A and B. But you're dropping part of that very long range tail. Okay, since everyone's probably experts here on this, I'll just review what notation I'll use. So since we're doing DMRG, we can think of this as working in the space of matrix product states. So the matrix product states are specified by a set of tensors, which are called B, such that if I take the B and string them together, I get my wave function. So the important parameter here is in this internal bond, which is summed over, I have to decide how many states there are. So the dimension here I'll write is chi. Now the question is, how large does chi have to be in our simulations? So generally, chi is set by the amount of entanglement between the two halves of the chain. Since we're in two dimensions, that entanglement is going like the circumference of the cylinder. So generally, chi is on the order of e to the lx. And since we have translation invariants, these are infinite matrix product states with essentially all the b are the same. Okay, and as we do the DMRG, it's in the matrix product operator formalism. So in the same way we played this trick with a state, we can do the same decomposition for an operator. So an operator, instead of just having here, which just has the index of the local Hilbert space, since the operator I have two, a bra and a ket. So the decomposition just adds a different, an upper leg here. So in the same way that a matrix product state is specified by a B matrix, the matrix product operator is specified by this W matrix. So the question again is to represent the quantum Hall Hamiltonian, which we said has say 300 terms affecting each site. What is this W going to look like? And I won't get into an exact form. It's kind of the point is the internal dimension you need here, I'll call D, is precisely that 1 or 2 or 300. So it itself is on the order of L squared. So these are fairly large matrices. And I should say, if you wanted to do a three-body interaction, which is what, for instance, the Mohr Reed state is the exact ground state of a three-body interaction, then this gets much worse. Then it becomes L to the fourth, which we haven't implemented. Okay, so the advantage of phrasing the problem in this formalism of that the Hamiltonian is a tensor network is that since I'm going to variationally minimize the energy of the MPS, I need to figure out what the energy is. Well, the energy is just this giant tensor contraction. So at the top, I have my ket, in the middle, I have my MPO for H, and at the bottom is my bra. So the expectation value, in principle, I just need to contract this infinite thing. Okay, but where you're proceeding iteratively. So the steps go something like this. I have in principle the energy E is this whole tensor network, but then I focus temporarily on, let's say, two sites, so two B matrices. And then I imagine varying them and see how the energy is going to change. So when I do that, I can just cut out the two sites, and I get what I can view as a matrix from the top of the bottom, which is essentially the entire Hamiltonian projected into a smaller space of Schmidt states and those two sites. So if I then diagonalize that Hamiltonian using Lankosch, I get a better guess for the wave function at those two states. I do SVD to bring it back into matrix product state form. And then I move to the right and repeat it. And I just keep moving right. And you can show in doing this that you preserve the translation invariance when you look at the details of it. And eventually, after, say, 20 iterations, it converges to a translationally invariant ground state. I should say one detail here. So normally people say do one or two sites at a time. But there's this really tricky problem with quantum Hall because of this conserved quantum number where you always have to squeeze things like this. If you just do two sites at a time, the DMRG will get stuck and it will stop moving. So this update isn't ergodic. So we actually have to update six sites at a time in order to get it to find the ground state. In general, that number would actually depend on the filling fraction. Okay. So I won't say anything more about the algorithm, but that's how we're able to get these ground states. Okay, but there's a subtle issue here when you're working on the infinite cylinder, which is I don't want one ground state. I want all the ground states, and I want them in the special basis, which we called the minimal entanglement states. So schematically, there are these pictures that each one has some anionic flux in them. Okay, so there's two issues. The first is, how do I know that DMRG produces this basis? And this was actually answered by Lukasz, and they argued that this basis is actually the eigenstate basis on an infinite cylinder. So schematically here, these are the actual energies in the problem. K is some quantum number. In my case, it's momentum. We have two groups. We have here are the degenerate ground states, and then a gap above, I have the rest of the states. So the idea is that these have some splitting, which is decreasing exponentially in the circumference, but each state itself is one of the minimal entanglement states. Okay, but then the question is, how do we get all of them? So as we formulate it, our initial state for the DMRG is just a tensor product, a chi equals 1, there's no entanglement in the orbital basis, so it might be 0110 repeated. So we put it in the DMRG and we get out some optimized state and energy, and then we record that energy. So let's say this one has quantum number 2. So I could repeat it again with a different state, which has a different quantum number. So there's two cases. If I repeat it with quantum number 6, I'll find that the energy I get out, since there's no MES, there will be higher. So I compare the energies and I throw that one out. Whereas if I get an energy which is equal to the first one and I got, then I know I found another minimal entanglement state with a different quantum number. Okay, there's a subtle issue here though, which is what if there is a quantum number sector which has two MES in it? How are you gonna get both of them? So actually in all the cases we studied for any abelian quantum Hall state and the Moore Reed state, every minimal entanglement state is distinguished by its quantum numbers. So it wasn't an issue. The first one where this is a problem happens to be the Reed-Rezai state. So we have some conjectures based on this. I'll just say briefly, the idea is, in fact, there's probably two different strings you could start with, either 0110 or 10101. Or if you start with them, even though they have the same quantum numbers, we expect they'll actually lead to two different ground states. This is definitely clear if you have a thin enough cylinder, because if you have a thin cylinder, the ground states actually reduce and become these tensor products. So the idea is there's some adiabatic continuity here. That's kind of a conjecture at this point because we haven't studied the Reed-Rezaei case.
Sorry, I did not understand the statement. So you previously, in other cases, in simpler cases, you could use quantum numbers to teach different analysis. What kind of quantum numbers were these?
Okay, so C is always, let's say, 1/2. So C doesn't matter, but the quantum number is K. So if I contrast these two, what I need to do is calculate the center of mass of this string.
Sorry, when you said C and K, K was the...
K was this momentum here, which we can think of as being a center of mass.
And C was...
C is just the charge. Yeah, sorry. So since we're working at a fixed filling fraction, C isn't useful in distinguishing MES. But the charge is. So for instance, if I compare, if you consider just these four sites, this one has its center of mass right in the center of the string, whereas this one has its center of mass shifted over by half a site. So they have different center of mass.
These are not local symbols.
Let's see, in real space, you couldn't measure that, no. In orbital space, it is a local observable.
So in orbital space, you still need to observe all that shift in the whole...
Well, I just mean, so when I'm using it as a spin chain, to measure K, it's just this observable is the quantum number. In real space, you'd be measuring the momentum around the cylinder. So I guess we kind of got lucky in that all of them are distinguished by quantum number. But the conjecture is it'd be enough to actually, these two strings you can see have the same center of mass, they're symmetric about the middle. But we think if you started the DMRG in the two of them, they would actually go to two distinct states.
So what's the intuition behind that?
There's two issues. One is, let's do a simpler problem. Imagine, suppose I have a splitting here, and imagine I inserted in the exact eigenstate or something very close to it of the higher energy one. We could ask, would the DMRG tunnel into the lower one? So the intuition here is that the way you tunnel between two minimal entanglement states is you have to make a quasi-particle, quasi-hole pair and then drag them out to infinity. So we'd say, what is the energetic gain of that? Well, on the one hand, because there's a splitting, there is an energetic gain to make a very long string because that type of ground state has less energy. But there's also an energetic cost to making the quasi-particles in the first place, which is the gap to make a quasi-particle. So the idea is since the DMRG is sort of acting locally within a correlation length, it's not going to want to first form that pair of quasi-particles in order to tunnel into the other sector. So that's why we think there's an energetic barrier to this tunneling between from the higher one to the lower one. So then the question is, how do I kind of start it close to the higher one? So here the intuition is from this idea of the pattern of zeros or the root configuration. So one way of phrasing it is if you took, for instance, the Laughlin state on a cylinder, I made it a very, very small circumference. You find that the exact ground state is just a pattern of 0, 1, 0, 1, or 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0. So, and depending on which of the minimal entanglement states you pick, it's a different orbital configuration. So the conjecture is if you start with that orbital configuration, it will, when you add fluctuations, it will turn into the ground state, but it won't tunnel to the other sector. That's the rough idea.
So is that, why do you need to, you're saying if you start with a very thin cylinder, then you could start with strings of zeros and ones?
Well, so for so there's these model Hamiltonians for which, say, the Laughlin state is an exact ground state. In that case, in a thin cylinder, 0101 is the minimal entanglement state.
And will you be able to extract all the information you want just from those very thin cylinders,
right?
Or do you need to go ahead?
Right, so that's a great question. So that was asked in this paper here by Zhao Gong and Wang. So their question was precisely like that. What would you learn just by knowing these orbital configurations? And it turns out for the abelian states, you can learn almost everything, but for the non-abelian states, you can't. So that's an interesting part of this problem. So for instance, when we were doing this for the Moore-Reed state, there's 6 degenerate ground states, and we find starting with these 6 different root configurations is what they're called, you end up with 6 orthogonal states. But in this case, it's trivial because it has to do just with the quantum numbers. Okay, so now you only have 15 minutes, so I'll try and go to the application. So the thing, now that we have the minimal entanglement states, what do we measure? So this is an idea of Zhao Gong's and Bakuri's from, well, almost 20 years ago. And the idea is, suppose we actually have the system on a torus. So when I make a torus, I imagine starting from the plane and then choosing 2 vectors in which I identify points. So the usual torus would be I just identify this line and that line and that line and that line. Okay, but you can make another torus by instead identifying along the vectors I've shown on the right. So we can parameterize this by just the offset tau x lx of the torus on the right. And you can see the interesting thing here is once tau x becomes 1, it's actually the same torus. So by taking tau to tau plus 1, I've chosen a continuous path of tori that return to itself, or it's a set of geometries which returns to itself. So the basic idea was for each type of torus, I find all the ground states, which are labeled by A, and then I continually deform the torus. And associated with that, I can calculate the non-abelian Berry connection. So it's just, how is this ground state changing as I change the parameter tau, which tells you how you've made the torus. Okay, and since once I've taken tau to tau plus 1, I get back the same geometry, that gives me my closed loop. Whenever I have a closed loop in a Berry phase, I can calculate some Berry matrix with it. So this is called the T matrix. And if I illustrate it graphically, if I had started with a cylinder with this loop around it, which I can think of as my anionic flux, once I've gone through the T transformation, this loop threads around both cycles. So roughly the idea is that I'm going to be able to measure something. This phase here is going to tell me about the fact that I now have an anion which is threaded around both cycles. Okay, so I'll argue that if you could measure this thing, there's 3 things you could measure. So the first one is HA, and it's called the topological spin. This is the part that comes from the fact that an anion has wound an additional time around the cylinder. The second thing we're going to be able to learn is the chiral central charge. So this one's a little bit subtle, but certainly if, say, for quantum Hall where you have this gapless edge, it's the central charge of the edge theory. And the third thing you can measure here, which is also completely universal, is related to the bulk. So you can see it depends on the circumference here, and it's called the Hall viscosity. So it turns out if you measure this thing U of T, the result is completely universal. You don't need to take any ratios. And the 3 terms tell you these 3 objects here, which are all known quantum numbers of the quantum Hall problem.
Sorry, so yep. with the game theory, you would compute this quantity as a function of L?
Right. So what you would do is you would take your ground state on a torus of circumference L. So let me just say here. So when I do the T matrix, I have to decide which way I shear it. So what you would do is you would calculate the non-abelian Berry connection by shearing it in the x direction and see what phase you get as a function of the circumference Lx. So we get this phase ut, and the idea is that the form of it should take this form. Okay, so I'm actually just going to rush through the intuition for why the 3 of them show up. So for the topological spin, The idea is, suppose I want to find the difference between an anion winding around one cycle versus two cycles. If I take this, if I take the path of the anion there and I imagine projecting it, splatting it down onto the plane, you'll see it now. So if I connect that with that, but it now goes, winds around once. And so you can use some of the rules from the topological quantum field theory in order to undo that, that kink. You end up acquiring a phase, which is called the topological spin. And the reason it's called a spin is you can also show that it's a spin in the usual sense. If you had this particle all alone by itself in the plane and did a 2π rotation of it, you get a phase back, which is this theta of A. So a fermion, for instance, this would be -1. But the interesting thing with these anions is it can be some actual fractional part. So this is one part of the anions we'd like to be able to measure. Okay, so the chiral central charge, this one's actually really, it's sort of interesting. It's hard to say why it shows up here. But another place it shows up is if you were to put on a real edge, a physical edge, and you put the system at finite temperature, you'd be able to measure a current of energy running around the edge of the system. And that current there is proportional times the temperature squared, again, times this chiral central charge. So it turns out we argue that the two effects are wick rotations of each other, which is sort of interesting. Okay, and the third one is the Hall viscosity. So this is sort of peculiar to quantum Hall. So the idea of a Hall viscosity is, imagine I have some shear flow like this. So I have a higher velocity over here. Like a normal type of viscosity, you would get a force gradient in the direction of the shear. Whereas with this Hall viscosity, you instead get a pressure. So you shear the fluid like this, you would have to push in order to maintain that flow. So in terms of the stress tensor, it tells you that the diagonal part of the stress tensor is related to the off-diagonal part of the shear. And the coefficient is called the Hall viscosity. So roughly speaking, you can see when I'm doing this T transformation, I'm shearing the bulk. And this, I think I'll sort of skip through this, but this shows up here as a Berry phase you can calculate. It comes from the strain, which is related to Lx over Ly times the area. And you end up getting exactly what you would expect, this L squared dependence. I'll skip the sort of intuition for it here, but what this tells you, it was shown by Nick Reed in 2009 that the Hall viscosity is actually related to a number called the shift, which tells you if you put a quantum Hall state on a sphere, there's a mismatch between the naive filling fraction and how many electrons you actually have to put on the sphere in order to realize the state. And so that shows that it's quantized. So if you measure the Hall viscosity, you've measured the shift. Okay, so how do we calculate this? Okay, so the first step is, suppose I just have the simple cylinder where there's no twist in it. So I've ran the IDMRG and I get this infinite matrix product state. And so as I probably Lukasz argued earlier, to get the ground state on a torus, all I need to do is I take the matrix product state and I cut out a segment of it, and then I glue the two ends together. So schematically, each of these is the B matrices of the infinite matrix product state, but I can find the ground state on the torus without having to rerun the DMRG. And the reason for this is because the reduced density matrices only depend on the B matrices in some local patch. Okay, but now the question is, we might worry that as I start shearing the cylinder, I have to rerun the DMRG. But what we were able to prove was, when you put this twist in, it's actually sufficient that when you re-glue it together here, you can just insert some matrix G. And that's kind of interesting because even though the shear is occurring in real space, there's nevertheless, you can prove that there's an exact solution in orbital space, this matrix G. And the form of this G doesn't matter that much, but the basic idea is it's just a phase factor, which says if an electron with momentum K jumps across the link, then give it a phase e to the 2 pi I tau K. So it's just kind of every time an electron fluctuates where you glued it, you give it a boost with that phase factor. Okay, but all we need to take away from this is that for any modular parameter, you can get the ground states again without having to rerun the DMRG. We have an exact relationship between the untwisted and the twisted states. Okay, so now all we need to do is, in principle, you can just take the overlaps and you would get your Berry connection. So the neat thing is when you go to take this Berry connection, you find that a huge number of turns sort of drop out and the whole thing simplifies. And you find that when you calculate this Berry connection and integrate it, the result, which I've written here, we don't have to understand the exact form, in fact, can be calculated only knowing the entanglement spectrum of the infinite cylinder. So the point here is that we know the effect of the T transformation if we know the entanglement spectrum on an infinite cylinder. So that means that to measure these three quantities, all I need to know is the entanglement spectrum from my DMRG. So the basic idea is you put this in, which is the numerical entanglement spectrum for the 2/5 state, and I measure this quantity as a function of the circumference, and everything to start is inaccurate, but as you take the system size to be large enough, I get a very nice result for the central charge. This is the Hall viscosity, which I've written as the shift, and the topological spin H. So it turns out for the abelian states, like I was saying, certain properties are actually already determined just by this thin torus function, the 0101. So that's why in this case, H is already correct at a low circumference. But the other things, you have to go to a large circumference.
So you're saying that you just take the spectrum?
Yeah. So what it is, the exact data is a list of the values, the amplitude, and the quantum number for the momentum and charge associated with each value.
What amplitude? The amplitude is a real number?
Yeah, just the Schmidt coefficient. So the data is the Schmidt coefficients and then the charges. And then you compute this thing and you get these numbers out. So in comparison to what you guys worked out, so on the one hand, you're getting less information because you're just getting T. But on the other hand, there's no complicated overlaps to do. You can just instantly compute it because it just involves the entanglement spectrum. And I should say, after we put this out, essentially the analogous result was worked out by the Stanford group if you had a lattice system. So it turns out also for a lattice, just knowing the entanglement spectrum, you could calculate the topological spin, and conceptually it's the same.
Can you get the S from here as well?
No. So I'm very curious whether, I've been thinking about this, whether there's a similar trick for S, where just knowing entanglement spectrum you can get S, rather than having to do an expensive overlap. So that's a great question. So the trivial thing about this is, since it's an abelian, it turns out that this is just identically correct. So I'll do it once for the Mohr-Reed state, which is non-abelian. So the Mohr-Reed state has this anion, which has charge E over 4. So I call it sigma. So I have four panels here. First, I just plot the what this phase is for two particular minimal entanglement states, the trivial one and the sigma one. So they do something funny for a little bit, and then I've plotted as a function of L squared. So eventually they are on a line, but they have a different constant offset. So knowing those offset, I can first extract the topological spin of the non-abelian anion, and I get 1/8. And the important thing here is I would have gotten it wrong if I used the thin cylinder. Second, this is the Hall viscosity. And then third, the central charge. So I get 3/2, which comes from having a fermion and a boson, if you were to cut an edge on the system. And so all this is from the entanglement spectrum of a infinite cylinder.
So this gives you the central charge mod 24,
right? Yes. Speaking. Yeah. Yeah. So I think we thought about there's actually a way. So previously it was known from the topological field theory you could get the central charge modulo 8.
Right.
This is a modulo 24, but we think there's a related effect if you put it on a curved surface where you could get it absolutely. So we know it has some absolute meaning because when I said this heat current is
that's unique. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so I will zoom through this. So to do anions, the idea is if I put an anion here, I make a pair and I pull one of them out to infinity. That's going to appear as a domain wall between two different minimal entanglement states. So to do this numerically, I start out and find the infinite matrix product states. On the left, I choose the B matrices of one sector. And on the right, I choose the B matrices of the A sector. And then I leave, say, 60 sites in between hand and numerically optimize them. And that's going to guarantee that there's a quasi-particle of type A somewhere in between them. So I've done this for the Laughlin state. And here the nice thing is since the anions are charged, I can put on a potential in real space, just some like delta potential. And that will localize them. So here, I don't know if you can see, there's always two red dots. And that's where I put the delta potential. I start out with them far apart and then started dragging them together. And you can see they move together up until the last two slides. And then the repulsion, due to the fact that there's, in this case, a 1 over r cubed interaction, one of them goes to the center and the other flies off to the, it's on the other side of the cylinder. You can see it here. So what we're looking at with this is actually some more energetic questions. I could change what the form of the pseudo-potential is, or what the interactions are, and perform the same thing, and I get pretty different behavior. So in this case, the quasi-particle flew as far away as it could, whereas in this case, it actually ends up forming a bound state. You can check that it's actually one is here and one is at the center. So then there's actually lots of energetic questions you could ask, like if you put a dilute gas of these quasi-particles, so the filling fraction is 1/3 plus epsilon, you could ask, for instance, does it form a Wigner crystal or does it phase separate? And so this is more in this intermediate range of energies, but I mean, it's pretty relevant if you want to know what you would observe in some real system. So this is a project I'm working on with Sid at Berkeley now to look at the energetics of this problem in order to study some of the phase diagrams. Yeah.
So if you want to compare the results with some real system, the real system won't be on a cylinder in momentum.
Right.
So is that a natural translation?
Right. Well, so I guess when I say real results, like what I might want to know here is, suppose I know in the real system what these pseudopotential Vs are. And what I wanted to know was, what is the effective interaction between the two quasi-particles? So in this case, for instance, what I've done is I've plotted the energy as a function of the distance between them as some parameter which describes the potential change. And you see whether or not there's a dip here. So I mean microscopic in the sense that you would be computing something like this effective interaction between quasi-particles.
Right. Yep. So far I wasn't too worried about the fact that you work with an orbital space because you were looking at universal properties. I can buy that. The universal properties won't depend on these details.
Yeah.
But then here you are looking at the energetics. Now you're looking at microscopic details.
Yeah.
And so is it to understand that whatever we learn here can be mapped into say the plane?
So first, basically, I mean, on the one hand, there's the finite size effects, and then so it might be a little bit subtle if you have a Coulomb interaction, because then there's always some finite size effects.
If you don't have finite size effects.
Oh, yeah, then you expect that the plane, the cylinder, doesn't matter. Because it's this fact that it appears to look different is kind of illusory. It's just, it has to do with the gauge choice. So you need to know things like that the higher Landau levels aren't important, which is another microscopic question. But like in this case, that's true. But you'd want to add things like spin, because that is also important for energetics. Okay, and Gaul, end the talk there. Thank you.
More questions?
Can I try to understand the algorithm better? So you contract the two sites, and you keep moving along.
Yeah.
And so this gives you the infinite part of the cylinder. And what about the other dimension?
Meaning around the cylinder.
Right?
So the thing is the point was that when I have this infinite cylinder, the one-body Hilbert space, even though it has this dimension around here, are these orbitals phi n, these Gaussian packets like this. So the fact that this is a discrete number here is what let me represent it as a spin chain. But the form of the interaction knows that there's this dimension running around here.
So are you separating into different spin chains with different quantum number around the cylinder?
So that's what's different about this Landau level problem. So like, so you might be thinking like, if I had a cylinder which was a lattice model, which looked like this, that I would take six spin chains and they'd be coupled together. But the point of the quantum Hall problem here is, in some sense, what my orbitals look like is, if I had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 here, it's more like there's six orbitals, 5, 6. And these six here encompasses the Hilbert space of this region right here.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no different chains for different points around here. There's only one spin chain. I shouldn't really call it a spin chain. It's only one.
Sorry, did you just say that you are grouping six orbitals into one?
No. What I meant, I might be a little bit confused about the question, but I was just contracting. If I had a lattice model, let's say with circumference 6, for some fixed region here, I would have six orbitals like this.
Okay.
And so, for instance, I might let my chain go like, if I make it a 1D problem like this.
Yeah.
Okay, but with quantum Hall, the one-body physics is different. You don't have six orbitals like this. Instead, I have six orbitals which are like 3, 6, and each one is a narrow strip.
Okay.
Not a very good drawing here. But the point is, the Hilbert space of some region here is just these six orbitals.
But the orbitals are choice of places, right? You can make real combinations of those and get orbitals which are localized.
Yeah, exactly. So I could do a right. So this is how you get the S matrix. If you wanted, you could do some linear transformation of the orbital, these Landau level orbitals, and instead make them Gaussians this way, localized this way. But the problem is then you wouldn't be able to do numerics with it. This is the basis we're using is a nice one because you have this conserved quantum number.
More questions? It's all about again.